Welcome to the Sisters for Prevention Breast Cancer Resource Podcast and YouTube channels. I am your host, Judy Fitzgerald, and it is my great pleasure to bring you the latest information and strategies for breast cancer survival and prevention. I am a 12-year breast cancer survivor living with NED, no evidence of disease. My passion is supporting the primary prevention of breast and ovarian cancers. It is my great honor to serve as a consumer advocate for the breast and ovarian cancer vaccines developed by Dr. Vincent Tuohy at the Lerner Research Institute at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. 2021 was an exciting year for breast cancer. It was the year we launched the Phase 1 clinical trial for the first preventive breast cancer vaccine. This vaccine is presently being tested on recently diagnosed triple-negative breast cancer patients who have completed treatment. Our goal is to prevent recurrence in these patients. Sadly, triple-negative breast cancer is the most lethal form of the disease and has the highest probability for recurrence within the first 5 years. So what's next? We will need support to complete all phases of the clinical trials to obtain FDA approval. Once the vaccine is proven safe and effective, the Cleveland Clinic has partnered with Anixa Bioscience and their CEO, Dr. Amit Kumar, to commercialize the breast and ovarian cancer vaccines and make them available for use. For all things breast cancer and to remain updated on the vaccine's progress, please visit my website, www.sistersforprevention.com. That's sistersforprevention.com. And now it is my great pleasure to bring you today's program. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the Sisters for Prevention Breast Cancer Resource and Wellness Channel. It is my great pleasure today to have as my guest, Anne Fonfa. Anne is the founder of the Annie Appleseed Project and has been an advocate for all of us going through this journey since her own diagnosis 22 years ago. Anne has constantly championed the importance of diet and lifestyle, as well as the inclusion of complementary medicine into the treatment of breast cancer. So we're going to focus today on answers to questions that we wish we had had when we were going through our journey. So thank you for joining me, and I hope you'll enjoy the program. Thank you.
Hey there.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm good. I was just listening to a doc talk about breast cancer issues to an audience of doctors. She started out by saying she doesn't know much about lung cancer or melanoma, but how many people in the audience know someone with breast cancer? And of course, we know that's a huge number. So, everyone was laughing chuckling, it's so ironic. It's a huge thing, huge, ridiculous, beyond, And then this is what I actually wrote down to talk about. Maybe we talked about it before, She said, oh, we've reduced the death. But in fact, some evidence shows that it was about quitting smoking more than anything. Plus, the other thing I wrote down, the five-year nonsense. If you live 5 years and 2 days, man, you're in the stats as a survivor, and the treatment worked and you cured and loved, which is unfair. But they wanted a standard, so 5 years was a relatively safe standard for everything but breast cancer. I would like to talk about things they don't tell you, but the way that I found this out was by being in a support group. The problem with that was we'd already been through treatment. We'd already been, so it was too late to correct what we didn't know. But finding those things out, I've always tried to share everything that I found out. And you mentioned the nerve. So that's one of the most ridiculous things of all. In order to, when they go through to take your lymph nodes, which nowadays they take less, that's true, but they still do the same method. They cut the brachial nerve. So it's in the upper arm. Everybody pretty much can identify a dead zone where they don't feel anything. Even I'm 29 years out and I have a dead zone still. I don't feel anything. So in my support group was a woman whose father had breast cancer. So first thing was, she said her doctor told her it didn't matter that her father had breast cancer. That wasn't important. And, I'm like, wait, in eighth grade, again, you know, I remember biology, you get this from mom and this from dad, and that's you with the two of them. And she was told, oh, no, your father did. That was ridiculous. And we all knew it, but the doctor said that to her. Okay, second thing, she told us that she told her surgeon, don't cut the nerve. And her surgeon did not. So I went back to my surgeon next visit. I say, why did you cut it? And he says, well, it's possible that it will develop scar tissue and then we'd have to go back and cut it. So I say, okay, so you cut it because it might develop scar tissue and then you'd have to go back and cut it. And he says, yes. And I said, the stupidest thing I have ever heard. For the rest of my life, I have no feeling in this area because you're worried that it might get scar tissue later on. It might not. But I happen to know, tip for listeners, a way to deal with scar tissue internally, and that is cocoa butter. I used organic cocoa butter topically on the outside. It penetrates the skin, approaches the scar tissue, and dissolves it. This happened for me in exactly 3 months, exactly. But, you know, it could take 4 months or even 2.5, I don't know, but it's worth a try. In addition, this surgeon who became my ex-surgeon pretty quickly, but I started out by having, you know, pretty swollen chest. And I imagine most people do after a lumpectomy. And I was putting ice on it, swelling, you know, I didn't know about Arnica at the time. Arnica, fabulous, mm-hmm. under the tongue or topically, if you don't have an open wound. Great stuff. And he says to me, oh, your chest, yeah, he didn't say the ice isn't going to do a damn thing, which he should have, but he didn't. Humored me, which was bad. Then I come in the next week or two and I say, look at my arm. Wow, my arm is swollen, my forearm, which is still swollen. In any case, not a lot, but it's still swollen. And he says, oh, yes, your arm is swollen. No discussion, no anything. And the following week, I wake up and I start doing my floor exercises and my left hand hurts. And I had this bubble of lymph fluid and it's really raised up like a, you know, like this. And I go back, oh, my God, my hand. Look at my hand. He says to me, oh, yes, your hand is swollen. End of story. And this was in like late February. March, April, May, I'm going down to Washington, D.C. to meet my sister, to march with her in the Pride March down there in 1993. And I'm reading a newsletter from one of the California breast cancer groups. And I think it was, they changed their name, so I'm not going to get it. But, and they were talking about lymphedema, and it was forever. And I was like, oh, I have another forever disease? I can't believe it. And I get off the train and I start crying when my sister shows up. I have another disease that's never going to go away. I couldn't believe it. But I wrote them a letter, which, you know, we didn't have email. I wrote a letter and I said, you know, you might not have realized, but I have lymphedema and it's actually treatable a little, but, you know, and this nurse calls me that same day that they got my letter. And she says, oh, we know what lymphedema is. I say, why couldn't you have told me?
Right.
It wasn't her fault. He didn't tell me. So that was the end of it. I, you know, stopped being his patient because how could I respect someone who, you know, he got paid every time I told him I had a swollen area. You know, I walk in, oh, this is swollen. Yes. He says, yes, it's swollen. And he got whatever it was. You know, I don't know how much they paid back then. I think it was $70, $75. It was insane. And it was so unfair because they did know about it. But, you know, I don't know if he was trying to deny responsibility. They used to say, the surgeon used to say, no, it's the radiation, radiation oncology fault. But I didn't have radiation, so it wasn't radiation. It was surgery. They took 18 lymph nodes. That's the other thing. The guy said to me day one discussion about it, you know, but do you have any questions? So I say, no. First of all, I didn't know anything. Secondly, I figured he told me everything, you know, naive, but I mean, back in the day, 90.
You don't know what you don't know if they don't tell you, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So one of my original 12 ideas was hand me the FAQ and we can go down the list together. And I can say to you, number 7, doc, what's an axillary node dissection? And then he might have said what it was, but instead, and people said to me, oh, but you signed the form. Yeah, but you signed the form when you're backless, on a table, no shoes, no glasses, no jewelry, no anything. And you're not even yourself. Sign this form so you can have surgery. You know, I didn't know. And I didn't know what axillary node dissection. I didn't know about nodes, period. Dissection, I knew. Axillary, I didn't know. And node, I didn't know. So, of course, I signed it. I was there for surgery. You know, fasted for whatever. It was insane and so unfair. And because that's a very important thing. And the reason he's supposed to tell you is because he's supposed to inform you about the harms that might happen, which of course happened. I got lymphedema, but it wasn't like he told me I might get lymphedema. And so I intuited getting it, you know, I just got it. And it was very unfair. And I know for a fact that some doctors are still not identifying it for patients because, For many years, I was the lymphedema hotline volunteer at SHARE in New York City, mm-hmm. sharecancersupport.org. And I would talk to people with lymphedema and they say, well, my doctor didn't say anything about it, you know, and unfair. And to this day, because as I said, I'm in touch with hundreds of people, probably more than hundreds, many hundreds every single year from all types of cancers. And they're not informed about some of the harms, which they should be, in my opinion. That should be absolutely part of the deal, which is why an FAQ would be great. Could easily do it. I mean, it's not like they're going to discuss something miraculously different with each patient. They're not. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, I understand you get bored with your job. You get used to doing it, but that's your job. There are, if there are seven things to talk about, you better cover them all.
Right.
But that's still not happening.
Well,
you and I would like to add nutrition and exercise and stress reduction.
So yeah. I did not have lymphedema after my mastectomies, but when I did my exchange surgery, about 2 weeks after my exchange surgery, all of a sudden I couldn't move my shoulder and I had a frozen shoulder. It was on the left side, which had the most aggressive cancer. So I thought maybe something, you know, again, I didn't know anything back then. So they sent me for physical therapy and I did have fluid buildup in my shoulder. And the physical therapist said to me, I wish they would tell survivors this when they have mastectomy, that this is a real possibility. And a lot of them don't get physical therapy because they don't know that it's caused by that. Because I thought, gee, just having the exchange, why would that be a problem? But it can happen anytime afterwards. So I'm sorry. So it is a big problem. So what else did you think that you learned after the fact of things that happened to you that you didn't know about? Or your doctor didn't tell you?
Yeah, it's interesting because there's, I mean, some things that didn't benefit me personally, but there was a woman in the group who was pregnant and, you know, had to make some awful decisions because of that. And so that, you know, that was informative. Almost everybody in the group was young. I was 40, I had just turned 45. The woman who's pregnant was in her 20s. And the woman whose father was diagnosed, she was in her 30s. So it was a whole range of ages. And that was really interesting because we kept hearing that cancer is a disease of older people. But really, that's not so true anymore. And, you know, you may note this, but in colorectal cancer, it's become very clear that younger people are being diagnosed. I totally believe that's lifestyle driven. There's so much. I mean, lifestyle can really make a difference in colorectal. You know, people go for screenings and they're health seekers. They want to know information. They should be given information on site, how to make some lifestyle, you know, no deli meat. It's been shown to be terrible. Nitrate. And it's certainly true for people with breast cancer as well. Nitrates and all the other issues that with high fat content and salt, all things that would be better to avoid, you know, and of course, added sugar and all the artificial things we've talked about. Yeah. But that came to me that I found really interesting. I meet people everywhere who had breast cancer, you know, in the supermarket line and the airlines check-in, and just because it is so common. You know, as I started out by saying, even among doctors, they either had it or know people or family members. It's just so common. And when I was diagnosed, it was called 1 in 9. In the 1970s, it was 1 in 14. And what is it now?
It's 1 in 8.
Yeah. No, I think it's down to 7, 1 in 7, and it might
Be
bordering on 1 in 6. So this is a horror story because, you know, what's the future? Women with no breasts or in danger of metastatic disease. I mean, it's a nightmare. And it must be. It seems so damn obvious that it's environmentally related. What we do, what we don't do, what we're exposed to, what we should be exposed to, you know, and I mean, I don't use sunscreen. I'm allergic to chemicals, so I don't cover any, I don't make up anything. And people tell me, oh, this, natural, that. It's just not worth it to me. I just don't. So, but if you go out with sunscreen and you never get any sun, you're harming yourself. Mm-hmm. But the majority of people do that. They slather before they go out, even if it's for a 10-minute walk to the store or, you know, down here a ride, but you go in your car and you've already got sunscreen on. There's something wrong with that. It's really problematic. And I think, you know, that's one of the issues we have, that people don't get sun exposure. You need some. I'm not saying sit out for 4 hours.
Yeah.
But yeah, you need some. Yeah. And, you know, we're human beings. We're meant to be getting some sun. And instead, we're under artificial light. I don't know what LED is going to do. I have that right now overhead. We don't know. It's pretty new, you know. Mm-hmm. But being outside all by itself is a thing. You've probably read there's studies that show you that being out in nature is extremely helpful. Walking barefoot, they say. Personally, I hate the grass in Florida. It just doesn't feel right. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard for me to walk barefoot. I've been trying it, but it's not fun. I just bought a grounding sheet. I have no idea if it's going to be helpful or not. It's supposed to help with sleep and, you know, make your balance your system. We'll see.
What is it?
It's a sheet, but it gets plugged into the wall. It has some kind of helpful current.
Okay.
And I've only been on it for 3 nights, so I can't say, but I did sleep well the first 2 nights. Last night was a bit of a problem. Now I wake up, I have some trouble falling back asleep in the night. And mm-hmm. last night was one of them, but the first 2 nights were not. I don't know if that was mind over matter. I'm suggestible. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, we'll find out. I'm testing it. I'm my own laboratory, have to be. But so, you know, then I discovered that there were people who never want to talk about cancer again. They don't want to hear about it. Right. They can't bring it up. And then there are people like us who mm-hmm. got into advocacy and never got out. You know, we want to make a difference. We have to make a difference. We can make a difference, just very, mm-hmm. very slow. You know, you have to hope that in your lifetime, you'll see the difference. Now, things have changed in my lifetime in the way that I wanted them to. Did I have anything to do with it? I don't know. You know, I can't really say. I will say that amongst the people who know me, of course, I've had an impact.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've always been on message, you know, but you have to be. Have to be. And, you know, I'm sure we have lots of African-American friends. They have to be on message all the time. You know, they're getting this short end of the stick all the time in every cancer, in every area, in everything, not just cancer. But it's so sad that, I mean, you hear it comes up over and over again. You know, what are the disparities? Why are there disparities? What can we do about disparities? But nothing gets done. It just gets talked about. Might be better. It probably is better, but it's not great. I mean, it's the same thing for people who live in rural areas. They're always, I hear on the radio in the morning, you know, they close this clinic and that hospital and this, because they're, you know, it's very expensive these days. And so if you live in a rural area, everyone was happy you had telehealth, but that's not good enough. You can't get examined from telehealth. It's just, that's not going to work, you know? Right. So that's a problem, and availability and also access. And then docs have prejudice. So not just racial prejudice, but everything. My mother said to me many years ago, if you're an old lady in the hospital, you could forget it. You know, they don't see you as a person. And now I'm an old lady. You know, I look at myself, I don't see old lady, but that's what they see, because that's what is, you know, and you get disregarded. It just happened to me. I probably ranted about that one of the times we were on. But so that's an issue. Elders, you know, they're not considered able to make a decision. They're not necessarily given full treatment. There's evidence that African-American people are not given enough pain meds because the doc's making some kind of terrible assumption. And mm-hmm. that's just a disaster. And for young people as well, they're probably less likely to get pain meds that are appropriate because doc's thinking, oh, you know, drugs and who knows what they'll do with it. Mm-hmm. It's a bad thing. And additionally, same thing with clinical trials. So you're all about clinical trials. And mm-hmm. one of the issues is decisions are made. And it reminds me, my husband was at a headhunter, an executive search firm. He ran an executive search firm. He used to say, I don't allow my clients to make a decision up, you know, ahead of time. Like in the old days, they used to say, well, we don't want to see any women. You know, we don't want to see any black people. We don't want to see any, you know, and he wouldn't allow that because the reality was you can't make that decision until you see the candidate. But it's the same thing. If you're kind enough to participate in a clinical trial, you can't make the assumption that this patient won't follow through with what's needed. But that happens a lot. And because, you know, it's known. I mean, there's some studies. ASCO did a couple of studies about that mm-hmm. and American Society for Clinical Oncology. And they showed that the doctors have lots of their own, you know, viewpoints and prejudices.
Prejudice, yeah.
Yeah. And it's pretty much the same ones. People who are, you know, or if you're a little odd in the way you present, they're not going to do it. And that's bad because, you know, we all hear cancer affects seniors more than anyone else, but there are very few seniors in clinical trials, very few. Well, and that's something you can rant about, you know, the inclusion and exclusion criteria in a clinical trial. It's absolutely designed to be impossible. You get the healthiest sick people on earth in the clinical trial, and then the drug is approved or not. It comes out in the real world. where everybody's got comorbidity, which means like diabetes and heart disease, high blood pressure, along with cancer. And then what happens? You and your doctor make an individualized decision. It's completely nuts. They have nothing to rely on. You know, they're going to guess what dose you should get and what, you know, how long you should take it. And it's just, it's unfortunate. And yet, interestingly, years and years and years ago, there was a study that said that up to 30% of people in a phase one, the first, you know, the first one, which is all about safety, were taking something else in the trial. We're doing some complementary thing. We don't know what, because they didn't ask that. And I always wonder about that. You know, they have these studies where they say, oh, people were doing complementary medicine, but we didn't ask them what they were doing. Oh, what good is that? You know, complementary medicine is just, it's a term, but it doesn't mean anything unless you know the details. And so many studies were like that. It was ridiculous. I'd write to the author all the time and complain, what was it that you were looking at? You know, good or bad? What? How can we tell if we don't know what you were doing, what they were doing, what the patients were doing? And a lot of the studies just said, oh, they did or they didn't do something. They didn't do complementary or they did. That's ridiculous. You know, we need to identify there might be something there. I mean, I feel there's a lot there and it needs to be noticed and worked on. But again, you know, the left hand and the right hand not speaking to each other very well. Back in the day when I was originally diagnosed, I had a good friend who became an acupuncturist and I started doing acupuncture for a variety of reasons. I didn't know what she was doing. I was just trying to be a nice friend. And she, my menstrual cramps were stopped. They never came back. I was 40, 41, 42. I'd had menstrual cramps for 30 years at the time. And I was like, this is the greatest thing I ever could have imagined. But you know, is that known? Not really. And did my doc want to talk to her? Not at all. You know, it's a frustration. It's better now. I mean, they tell me that a lot of docs have had acupuncture and they kind of understand, and lots of people have, but acupuncture is approved only for lower back pain, which is kind of crazy because in China, it's been around for, 5,000, 6,000 years, and it's used for everything. So it's just so weird. I mean, we have this separation for not a good reason. What if the East met the West and we actually talked to each other? But as you know, groups have their own studies. So the radiation oncologists speak to each other and the nurses speak and so on. And everyone's isolated in what they call their silos. They don't talk to each other. So there's no good way to bridge it except with advocates. And it's important.
Well, I think everybody just follows standard protocol. That's the problem. And they're so afraid to deviate from that. They're afraid they'll get sued.
Yeah.
And whatever ASCO says goes, basically. And that's kind of what it's come down to. But I think that we talked about the importance of networking with other advocates or other patients, because after my mastectomy, I kept having pain in my left side. And I'm concerned because that's where the invasive cancer was. And then I read about something called phantom breast pain, where this, you know, the nerves just, sometimes they're regenerating, sometimes they're just like you were talking about being cut. And it's so common, but they don't tell you about it. So of course your mind immediately goes to the dark side. And so if you feel, and if you're not networking or you're not active with other survivors, you don't ever get a real answer to that. Because I did ask my doctor and they go, oh, it's nothing. It's fine. You're fine. Well, why am I fine? Tell me why I'm okay so I don't worry about it anymore.
Yeah, that's not a very helpful answer at all.
Right.
No, I agree with you, phantom pain. So interestingly, and this has nothing to do with cancer, but years before in the 70s, which is 20 years before my diagnosis, there was a show on PBS about phantom pain for people who lost their hand or their, you know, their foot or their leg. And they were talking about ways to deal with phantom pain. Was a known thing. So our docs could know and could tell us, but they don't. So what they showed was people either rubbing the air around the, like, you know, let's say it was this hand that was gone and they would rub as though it were there. And, or they'd stand in front of a mirror and rub the other hand. Well, so I tried all that because I had years of nervy, you know, I called it lightning strikes. It just felt like lightning strikes. Mm-hmm. And so I would rub the air, rub the air, rub the air. I don't know. Again, mind over matter. But so what? You know, what if it was a placebo? It worked. You know, right. I'm not opposed to placebo. I mean, as we know, placebos are actually the best medicine we have. Generally speaking, 30% of people benefit from a placebo. So right. I'm probably one of them. But yeah, there are things you can do. And again, you're right. These are things we're not told. But they could so easily say Phantom pain is a real thing. I'm sorry you're dealing with it. Your nerves will eventually calm down. It takes sometimes a while. In my case, it took 3 to 5 years, but mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't happen anymore. But I see women on the post, or you know, breast cancer survivors on the post saying, I have this terrible thing going on and I don't know what to call it. But you know, it's something that I tell people, just try what I did. Try waving your hand in front of the air.
Well, right. It is like a lightning strike. It's like a twinge, but it's pretty powerful twin. The other thing that I don't think there's enough preparation for people when they have a mastectomy. I think that there's a lot that happens with that. It's not just the physical. I mean, when you have cancer, of course, you'll do anything to get rid of the cancer, but they don't really prepare you for the psychological effect of that, you know, losing a part of your body, basically. And they don't talk about it. They don't offer any help about it unless you yourself seek help about it. But like things like that, they only tell you what you need to know for the next visit.
Yes, I agree. Right. And usually they're behind a visit. So you're finding out tomorrow what you needed yesterday. Mm-hmm. It's a problem. But yeah, so the loss of a breast, that's right. It's a big thing. But, you know, it's medical to them, but it's our feminine self. And it's too casual, of course. You know, I guess I was thinking about that when you were talking about whether if you had a nurse navigator, would that would be better, or a buddy up, which I really favor. The minute you get diagnosed, you should get connected with somebody who's in the same situation. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the support groups do that. A lot of the patient advocate groups have buddies. They connect you with someone your age, your stage, the amount of kids you have, whatever is the thing. And they try to connect you. And that way you could get some feel for how it's going to be. Now, it's interesting because, you know, I think I handle things great. So when I first had the lumpectomy, I felt pretty, you know, pretty cool, pretty powerful. But my breast had this, you know, was swollen, but that swell calmed down a bit. And then I had a second lumpectomy, and then it was weird, and the breast looked weird, and I was not so comfortable with it. And then when I had the mastectomy, you know, I was kind of like warrior Amazon, only one breast, you know, I could do this. I had a group that I was running about natural medicine, and everyone was saying, oh, I had told people I'm going to wear spaghetti straps when I have no breasts, you know. That took so, but at first I looked at myself and I was like, oh, you know, I don't know who I am. I look like a boy with scars. You know, it was very odd, and I had a lot of pain about it. And I went to visit my sister and brother, who lived out in Vegas, and I spent a couple of days complaining and just dropping on them. You know, I'm so unhappy and this and that. And then I came home and I was wearing one of the skimpy tops that I said I would wear. It was stretchy white, and I had a black leather jacket on. And I was walking in Manhattan on University Place, and this gay man passed me, and he said to me, "Great bod."
Really?
I just cracked up. Yeah, and I said to myself, "Why don't you know, get over yourself?" So I got over myself. But it was a year and a half after it was 6 months after the second mastectomy. So I got over myself because it was just such an amusing situation that this guy, I guess he thought I was trans or something, but was very new back in the day. But that was just so interesting and so different. So I had to get over it. And then, you know, at first I was wearing a vest so that no one could really see, that I thought everyone could see through the vest. You know, they all had X-ray vision. They knew I only had one breast while I had one. And then once I had two breasts gone and I got over that, but then, you know, my husband said, "I'm not like you. I can't handle scars easily." So I kept my shirt on for years. I didn't show him that space, mm-hmm. even though it was healing. And then one day we were looking at a house down in Florida. We were moving. And he said to me, "Look at the shower. This is big enough for the two of us." And I said to him, "Well, how can we shower together when I don't take my shirt off with you?" And he said to me, "Why don't you take your shirt off?" And I said, "I don't know. 5 years ago, you said something." And he's been long gone, you know, and I didn't approach it again. And other people have that issue. You have to be clear with your partner. I have to be able to say things and talk about stuff. And I didn't, you know, I was protecting him to a ridiculous degree. And he didn't want that, you know, it was just a moment in time. And I made it years. A bunch of women are together. They'll show each other their faux breasts and show each other their no breasts. And mm-hmm. it's a riot. But that's the club you can do it with. You know, nobody's shocked or offended or anything. You know, the history of Therese Lassiter, she's the first, considered one of the early advocates. She was at Sloan Kettering. I think it was probably called Memorial Hospital back in the time. And she had a mastectomy long ago. She realized that going home with nothing wasn't great. So she developed this lamb's wool, you know, like a pod that women could use to stuff their shirt when they left the hospital. And she would go around and try to meet the women who were having mastectomies and gift them this wool form. And the hospital didn't want her to. And they were very mad at her. And every time they found her, they said, get out, you know. But she was a very wealthy woman and she persisted. You know, they wanted donations, of course, so they didn't arrest her or anything like that. But they would say, no, 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 you can't be in this room. And she kept doing it. So she became known for saying, yeah, this is a big thing. You know, you're going out with no breast. And in those days, they took everything, you know, they could. I mean, really, even up to the ribcage. So that was problematic. But she was an early advocate, understanding that women would feel bad in the beginning. And, you know, we all feel bad in the beginning, but then you get over it. You know, like I said, the first breast, I was a warrior woman. The second breast, I was like, oh, no, I'm not even a woman anymore. Like, what's going to happen, you know? Mm-hmm. But I got over that too, because you have to go forward. You know, you have to make up your mind to go forward. And I was lucky because when I was diagnosed in 93 was the first year that the National Breast Cancer Coalition had its first summit. And, mm-hmm. you know, there were 800 women there and I couldn't believe it. You know, there was always somebody who had a similar situation and you could find them and make connections. And of course, I'm the type, I work a room. When I go around, I had my little card to give out, you know, natural medicine and my phone number and my email. And I met everybody. it was good because, you know, I was amazed at how many wonderful women I met and, you know, a couple of men brave enough to be there. But it's the advocacy thing is super strong because if we don't say stuff, nothing will change. Nothing will change. Like I said, the medical community, I think, you know, they are their teacher's pet. So your teacher got trained 40 years ago and they trained you 20 years ago or 10 years ago. They're still on the same page. And then you stay that way too. When I was diagnosed, I worked for a computer graphics company. I sold business presentations every month. We got new software for the computers every month. Mm-hmm. And we had to upgrade and we had to change whatever was going on and, you know, go the new way. Then you get to medicine. Oh, every 40 years or so, we'll make a change. There's no rush. You know, like right now we're talking about circulating tumor cells. And mm-hmm. liquid biopsy. 1998, I went to San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium for the first time, and there were four or five posters out of Germany about circulating tumor cells. 1998, and now it's 2022, and we're still not quite there. We're talking about it. So, you know, what's the rush? It's not a moneymaker. That's one problem. You know, and we have these entrenched things. I mean, we have mammograms, not the greatest, but that's what we had for a long, long time. Dense breasts, yeah, you need a sonogram, but you got to have a mammogram too. You know, mm-hmm. just and everyone knows that ionizing radiation may be a cause of cancer, and that's what a mammogram gives you. It's just a totally, totally weird thing. So I had big breasts. The first time I went for a mammogram, I was probably 40. That's what you were supposed to do. And I come in and the tech says to me, oh, I got to go get the big tray. So,
oh, no.
She went and got the big tray while making me.
That's terrible, though.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. You know, like, oh, how come you have large breasts? I have to go. So anyway, but then she also plunked the top down, got hematoma, aka black and blue marks. All my whole breast was black and blue because she just plunked it down. I mean, it was not fun. But I didn't go back when I was 42. I went back when I found a lump. I was 44. So what? Even if they had found a lump at 42 or 40, they told me they lost my records. So at every stupid thing that could happen. So they couldn't find, you know, the problem, put them in the wrong file or whatever. Mm-hmm. I should have just taken them, but I didn't know to do that. Now I have my own records. I save everything. But mm-hmm. back in the day, they had nothing to compare to because even though I'd had a prior mammogram, they couldn't find it. Mm-hmm. Now is that. I'm sure a lot of people have that problem too. They don't compare. And also, you know, who's your reader? It depends on who reads the film and exactly. lots of, oh, and another thing, I was, one of the first places that I spoke at was a mall, a shopping mall in Manhattan. My mother was with me. We were tabling. And, my mother said to me, they don't even have a survivor speaking. Why don't you get up there? I'm going, oh my, I can't do that. She said, get up there. So I went to speak and I spoke to to the room. And then this woman came up to me, young African-American woman. She was 26. And she said to me, I have a lump and no one will take me because I'm too young. So I already knew that she wasn't too young, you know, because I'd been involved with Cher, and I knew you could be any age. So I helped direct her to my surgeon to go get checked. And I mean, it was unnerving to see that. And we know, certainly we know by now, that African-American women can be diagnosed younger than white women. So.
And they also get the most lethal form, triple negative.
Right. So, you know, that what is that about? Because Harold Freeman, who was the head of the President's Council on Cancer for years and worked at Harlem Hospital, and he's an African-American guy, and he said, yeah, but, you know, in the U.S., there's no African-American who's 100% African. You know, they don't have their mixed genes. I mean, I watched that show, Know Your Roots, and, you know, everybody's a mix of European and African and whatever. So it's hard to know what could be the cause for that. I'd really love to have that found out. And younger women get triple negative also. It's not, you know, it's younger women and African-American women, but we don't know why. I had lobular, invasive lobular, which was a rare thing. They kept telling me, oh, it's likely to go to the second breast. Oh, you know, it's most likely going to go to the second breast. But that didn't happen until last year. So I don't know. That would have been 28 years later. I don't know. It's so odd. I feel like the more we know, the more questions there are. And we really don't know very much at all, despite all the research, all the money, all the thoughts. All the everything, we haven't come as far as we should, in my opinion. We got a long way to go. I just saw this today in a interview, or no, the guy gave a talk, but they had the transcript, and he said, I put it on my Facebook page, well, when patients fail chemotherapy, we really don't have much to do. So this is something at meetings a bunch of us have jumped up and spoken about, and they still say it's, you know, removes them from any blame. Patient failed chemo, what can we do? You know, those failing patients, you know, it's a terrible thing. And it's really insulting in every possible way, I think. And it annoyed me all over again. So I posted it on my Facebook page, my personal page, because it's something I rant about. How dare you say patient failed chemotherapy? You know, it's crazy.
Well, really, I always hate when they say she lost her battle with breast cancer.
Yeah.
You don't think she wanted it? I mean, she hadn't. It makes me so mad, because I put on my page too, it's like that person fought with everything she had. Okay, we failed her, obviously, like you're saying. She didn't lose her battle.
No.
Medicine was the one that really lost the battle.
No, I agree. It's terrible. I mean, it's kind of always blaming the victim, so to speak, and that's just so wrong. Yeah, it's all wrong. But, you know, the doctors have a language, protects themselves, and they're used to talking to each other. You know, one of the worst things that I ever saw at I think it was ASCO years and years ago, these three doctors were chuckling with each other. And I heard one of them say, oh, yeah, she was telling me she's got a little kid, so she wanted to do everything. And I told her, well, you know, it's only going to give you a 3% benefit. And she wanted it. And they're all laughing because 3% benefit didn't sound like anything to them, you know. But to the women in need, it sounded like, wow, maybe this is going to help me. And they were laughing at her. And I went up to them and I said, you know, how dare you? If you're in a life and death situation and you have a young child, you're going to do anything that you're told that might help. How can you laugh about that? But, you know, that was it. I'm sure that they didn't stop laughing because I said so. But, you know, it was so unfair. So mean.
We talked about this in our last discussion together, where when you're given a dire diagnosis, you have a 3% chance of living. Well, I might be that 3%. Why are you doubting that I couldn't be in that 3%? You know, rather than
No, I agree. And then, you know, the other thing is people want to say that, doc, what, how long do I have? You know, well, doc should say, there's no way I know. Just live your best life. Mm-hmm. No, I was told I had stage 4 in 1997. I could have spent a lot of years looking over my shoulder, feeling bad for myself, but I decided to just live. And that worked out. Well, however long you live, that's your life. You know, you can't rearrange it. You have to live your best life while you're alive, no matter what. I mean, we're all going to die. Bottom line, everyone dies. It's how you live. It's so obvious to me.
Well, also, I think going back to what you wish your doctor would say,
yeah, that's a really big issue. That's a really big issue and a big problem. And our country is failing in that regard, totally. friend who was diagnosed at 42, and she said to them, "I don't want you to take lymph nodes." I don't know how she knew, we never talked that. And they said to her, "Oh," and she was a clinic patient, so they said, "Well, we have to get a psychiatrist in here because you're crazy." Psychiatrist came. She said, "No, I don't want to have my lymph nodes taken out." And she left. She never did a single thing after that. And she died at 46 because her tumor did not spread. It grew down into a lung, burst the lung tissue, and her lungs flooded. She died of having fluid in her lungs at 46 years old because, you know, they weren't sympathetic in any way. There was no loving care going on at all. Anyway, so yeah, I think the whole way we handle mental health and stress and all that, just wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also, I think you and I have talked about this, and everything we've talked about is there should be some nutritional guidance given. Like what you was going back to, what should your doctor have told you? You know, they don't tell you, they'll just say, eat whatever you want as long as you're feeling okay. They don't really give you anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And they, you know, they do that to children too. Like they really guilt trip the parents. Like, well, your kid wants ice cream. You're going to deny your kid ice cream. And they're, while they're having treatment and who knows, blah, blah. You know, it's not right. It's not right. I just I don't know, but they don't know about nutrition and they don't have a nutritionist right there, which they should. But, you know, unfortunately it costs people extra, not covered by insurance. Do we have the worst healthcare system ever?
Yeah,
I mean,
do.
Seriously,
yeah,
it's so backward. It's so backward. Anything that can risk reduce, we don't pay for. That's okay. We'll treat you later.
Well, when they have socialized medicine, if there's a vested interest on their part to focus more on preventing and looking at the cause as well.
Well, right now we just got a bill passed in Congress where in a few years we'll be able to negotiate with Medicare. You know, it's nuts because if Medicare, it does cover gym, I think, but I don't go to gyms, but if we did preventive medicine, not screening, but actually teaching people healthy behaviors, that'd be the greatest thing we could do. I mean, we have a nation of people with diabetes, a nation of people with high blood pressure, and certainly heart disease. It's just crazy. But there are simple things that people can do. It's been shown in studies. Mm-hmm. Think of Dean Ornish. Dean Ornish, the MD, who took men with heart disease and taught them to be vegan, taught them to exercise, showed them how to handle stress. Everybody benefited. And he's proven it with prostate cancer, too. Very focused on men, but that's okay. And, you know, it's just so obvious that that could make a difference. We need to head things off before you get sick. And diabetes, how do we treat that, which is a national epidemic and a disgrace? The fact is you take medicine for your whole life and you still lose. Your kidneys still get harmed. You still lose a limb. It's wrong. Everything's wrong about that. But anyway, I ding big pharma and everyone knows I do.
Thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or on feedspot.com. Your feedback is important in helping us select topics for future podcasts. To stay updated on the latest news about the vaccine clinical trial, please subscribe to my website, www.sistersforprevention.com. That's sisters, the number 4, prevention.com. Also, please note that the topics discussed on this site are not meant to be used in lieu of medical advice. I am not a medical professional, nor do I claim to be. I am merely sharing what I have learned from personal experience, discussions with fellow survivors, and many hours of research. So for now, I'll leave you with my mantra: cancer is a word, not a sentence. So may God bless you and keep you till next time. Thank you.